Well, before we call the second case for the day, I believe that we have some students who are visiting for this oral argument. I think Edgewood High School, if my notes are correct, with the students and their advisors, please stand. Oh, quite a big group. You really fill up our courtroom. Very nice. You may be seated. Well, we like to have the students come and visit us and learn a little bit more about what goes on in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They are part of a program that we operate in combination with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. So they get a little bit of information about the case, they hear oral argument, and then after this argument is over, Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who sits to my right, will meet with the students and talk a little bit about procedures in the Supreme Court. Now, we've taken a look at you all, and I'd like to introduce each member of the court to the students as well. On my far right, Justice Michael Gableman. Next to him, Justice David Prosser. Next to me, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her is Justice Annette Ziegler, and on the far end is Justice Rebecca Bradley. So with the introductions made, I will call our second case of the day. 15 AP 869, City of Eau Claire versus Booth.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'm Eau Claire Assistant City Attorney Douglas Holker. Also here on behalf of the
You're
City of Eau Claire.
You're going to have to speak directly into the microphone and maybe raise that podium.
Before you start, our marshal can help you a little bit. She knows how to get things hooked up in the best possible way. We are having sound problems, counsel. So, you know, if the court has trouble hearing you, it's not your fault. We're trying to work on it, but we just had difficulty.
It's not often I'm told I need to speak louder, so I will do my best.
Well, good. Thank you very much.
Rely on your indoor courtroom voice.
Will do.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Eau Claire Assistant City Attorney Douglas Hofer. Also present today on behalf of the City of Eau Claire is Assistant City Attorney Janessa Stromberger and City Attorney Stephen Nick. In 2014, while her seventh OWI offense was pending, Booth Britton filed a motion to challenge her 1992 Eau Claire first offense OWI conviction on the grounds that at the time of the OWI first offense civil judgment, there was an existing 1990 Minnesota conviction. The circuit court's grant of the motion to vacate the 1992 Eau Claire first offense OWI conviction should be reversed for the following reasons. First, as this court said in Village of Trempealeau v. Mickroot, constitutionally granted circuit court subject matter jurisdiction cannot be revoked by statute. Second, the court should clarify or distinguish Walworth County v. Roner, which should not be read as broadly as Booth Britton requests. Third, the court should interpret Wisconsin Statute 346.65 consistent with the intent and language found in Wisconsin's drunk driving statutes. Fourth, the court should not reward Booth Britton's 22-year delay in bringing her motion to vacate the 1992 OWI civil judgment. First, the court should apply Village of Trempealeau v. Mickroot. In Village of Trempealeau v. Mickroot, this court held that a uniform traffic citation, albeit a different uniform traffic citation than we have in this case, issued without statutory authority is issued without court competency rather than without subject matter jurisdiction. Again, part of the same portion of Wisconsin's traffic laws were implicated in Mickroot that are implicated in this case at present.
Counsel, with regard to Mickroot, that case dealt in part with all circuit courts have subject matter jurisdiction of all civil and criminal, it proclaims. It doesn't suggest the same for municipal courts. In the state of Wisconsin, there are, as I understand it, 237 municipal courts, 240 municipal judges. In many of those municipal courts, OWI firsts are tried. How, if at all, does your McRoot argument apply to these 237 municipal courts?
Well, first of all, obviously this case deals, the OWI civil judgment in this case was from a circuit court, so we're not dealing with that question. However, to the extent this court wants to decide that a lack of court competency is what's implicated when a court issues the decision, that could be applied to municipal courts as well as circuit courts.
Well,
the
I'm going to be more detailed because I want to make sure I ask a better focused question. Do municipal courts have subject matter jurisdiction of criminal offenses?
No.
Okay. So to the extent that it was really a criminal offense, an unknown prior first, the municipal courts would not have subject matter jurisdiction. Is that right?
Well, the municipal court subject matter jurisdiction is definitely more complicated than the circuit court subject matter jurisdiction in this case.
Well, it's my understanding that municipal courts do not have subject matter jurisdiction of criminal matters. It's further my understanding that if there is no subject matter jurisdiction, a judgment is void, period, regardless of forfeiture or consent. You can't consent to avoid judgment. So my concern as I drill down with those premises is, aren't you advancing here a rule that will apply in certain jurisdictions where the charge of OWI first can be held in a circuit court, but not in all of those jurisdictions where they have municipal court? And that seems a problem. You know, you want consistency, you want predictability in the law. You don't want, well, if we'll do it this way if you do it in municipal court, we'll do it this way if you're in circuit court, and a fifth of the state does it in circuit court this way, but four-fifths, and I, by the way, am using those fractions as hypotheticals, but there's a large number of municipal courts. Please.
It is definitely a more complicated question. I completely agree municipal courts lack subject matter jurisdiction to attend to criminal matters. However, an OWI first offense is not a criminal matter. Now, the issue whether or not the municipality has authority to bring a first offense when there is a prior offense is a complicated question. It's not a question in this case because municipal court jurisdiction is granted a different kind of jurisdiction under the Wisconsin Constitution than circuit courts are.
Why is it complicated? They don't have jurisdiction over criminal matters.
But they do have authority to hear OWI first offense civil offenses. And I'd point out there is a wide body of case law where defendants have been charged civilly in a municipal court or in a circuit court and then charged criminally for facts arising under the same offense. And this court has held, for example, in State v. Thierfelder, that there's no double jeopardy implication. State v. Thierfelder was a case where a defendant was convicted of an OWI first offense and then later convicted for a criminal OWI offense out of the same facts and circumstances. I believe it was because of an injury. And this court held that that was permissible.
We had those cases with possession of marijuana also.
Also, and there's disorderly conduct cases and criminal damage to property cases. And so your point that you can't try a criminal case is well taken, but whether the municipality has the ability to bring that civil charge and whether the municipal court has the authority to hear that civil charge, I think is a complicated question that, again, is outside the scope of the facts we have in this case?
Outside of the scope of the facts, because this was a circuit court. But we always want to know what the ramifications of our decisions are. And I'm concerned about a ramification that would have a hodgepodge application.
And I think that concern is a very good concern. And I think the court could, if it wanted to issue a broader ruling, could issue a ruling that says that municipal courts, again, lack competency to hear an OWI first offense if there's a valid prior conviction. And in most cases, whether the challenge is brought under subject matter jurisdiction or court competency, the difference is meaningless. As this court pointed out in Miller Brewing, the main difference is that a competency rule requires parties to bring the challenge within a reasonable amount of time.
Also, it's significant in a difference because subject matter jurisdiction cannot be consented to, cannot be forfeited as an issue, as opposed to competency. Our case law would suggest otherwise.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that point up because, you know, one of the results of accepting Booth Britton's argument in this case is that prosecutors are put in a position where they would have, they're almost given a duty to be omniscient, where not knowing about a prior conviction, for example, in Illinois, many OWI first offenses are sentenced to something called supervision. This court has said supervision constitutes a valid prior conviction under Wisconsin law. However, supervision convictions are not reported to the national database, so there's no way the prosecutor could know about them and no way the Department of Transportation could know about them. And so a prosecutor could take a step, accepting the Booth Britton's position in this argument, of having a defendant enter a stipulation or entering a plea where they agree, I have no prior convictions. I waive my right to challenge the authority of the court to enter this OWI first conviction. And under Booth Britton's interpretation, 3 years later, when the criminal statute of limitations runs and it's not told for an OWI civil conviction, Booth Britton or any defendant could bring a challenge to that court's authority. And because subject matter jurisdiction cannot be waived, the court would have no choice but to vacate that conviction, even though the defendant stipulated that they had no prior OWI convictions and stipulated that they were waiving their right to challenge the conviction.
You know, you brought up convictions in other states and how they're handled, you specifically the state of Illinois. I wonder if any survey has been done, if either of the council know that the 49 sister states of the state of Wisconsin, whether all of the offenses of driving while under the influence have the same elements. In other words, is it possible that someone who is brought into court in Wisconsin for what everyone, as far as the government is concerned, believes is a first offense, but actually has a prior conviction, are there states out there where the argument could be made that because of a difference in elements, the first offense, the actual first offense that took place in Hawaii, would actually be counted as a first offense in our state due to a difference in elements? What is your awareness of that?
That's true. And that's another, you know, to borrow my earlier phrase, another complicated issue, that there are many out-of-state violations which may or may not constitute a valid prior conviction for Wisconsin purposes. If you accept that the loss of court authority is a loss of subject matter jurisdiction, a prosecutor could, again, enter a stipulation or have a plea with the defendant where the defendant agrees that out-of-state violation does not constitute a valid prior conviction, and then could wait 3 years for the criminal statute of limitations to run, bring a motion to vacate, and if the court determines that that prior violation does in fact constitute an actual prior conviction, the court would have no choice but to vacate that judgment.
Right, 343-307-1D
I've dealt with those motions when someone does wish to challenge an out-of-state conviction. And, for example, they might be charged with a second offense, but they say the prior offense from another state doesn't have substantially similar elements to it, and so, judge, this needs to be tried as a first offense, or this needs to be tried as a second instead of a third. Mm-hmm. Those challenges are brought routinely to trial courts, and then judges have to reach that conclusion. So how does that impact your argument today? Do you think that supports?
Well, I think it does support. And what the challenges you're talking about, where they're brought in a timely manner, are not the problem. The problem is when they can be brought 3 years later after.
Oh, but let me challenge you on that a little bit. If I determine that the prior shouldn't count and something is tried in Wisconsin as a first offense, someone could later say, oh, it really should have been tried as a second offense. And, you know, or somehow challenge either one of those, depending on the judge's ruling. Because there is a big difference in Wisconsin, not so in other states, but in Wisconsin anyway, the prior from another state has to be substantially similar to be used in Wisconsin.
And if the court uses a court competency analysis, then once it's tried and the court has an opportunity to hear it, the defendant would have to either raise a challenge on appeal or their argument would likely be waived. Where if it's a subject matter jurisdiction issue, the defendant could come back later at any time, and because subject matter challenges generally cannot be waived, bring that challenge and have it completely vacated.
Waiver, however, is an individual case-by-case basis. If you follow the line of cases dealing with competency, some of them suggest that the objection can be waived depending on the circumstances of the case. They go on to state that waiver is a tool of judicial administration. So under certain particular facts, you may, as a court, say it's waived, or maybe not. It's a tool that we can apply based on the individual facts. We are inclined oftentimes to have statements of law. That's what we are about, as opposed to, well, it might apply here, but it won't apply here, painting with a broader brush with greater consequences. Why is waiver an acceptable approach here?
Well, I think the approach here is one that combines kind of the best of a bright line rule that's found in MCRUT, but also gives courts an opportunity in individual cases, as you said. And as MCRUT pointed out in Statute 751.06 and 752.35, which deal with discretionary review of the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court to disregard a waiver, if there are exceptional cases where the facts really demonstrate that a challenge was brought within a reasonable time or is otherwise, you know, if justice so demands that the waiver be disregarded, courts do have the ability to do that.
Well, you know, you use the word waiver, but I'm not sure the context of what you're saying leads me to conclude you might actually be referring to forfeiture.
Yes.
Waiver requiring an affirmative waiving of rights by a person in court. But what is of more interest to me is several times now, almost in passing, you've referred to, well, if the circuit court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. Give me an example of when a circuit court lacks subject matter jurisdiction.
This court has articulated three instances where a circuit court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. First, if a federal court has exclusive jurisdiction by operation of the Supremacy Clause. Okay. Second, if there's a facially unconstitutional statute, it's null and void from the outset and the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. This court has also mentioned if a criminal complaint states an offense not known at law, the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes, all true, thank you. But the parties, an unknowing party, may hail into court another party in even any of those three or any of them individually or any combination, but someone at the trial court, particularly the judge, has to make that determination and do something affirmative to send it back. I mean, it's not a matter of a nullity as far as the authority of the court to make the determination. And if the court makes an incorrect determination, then that determination is subject to review.
Agreed. And I'm not sure if you have a question that...
I want to point everybody's attention to the very narrow phrase of, or the idea that our circuit courts lack subject jurisdiction in a wide variety of things, or any of the three narrowly, closely framed issues that you just mentioned, because our trial courts, our circuit courts, are the highest level of trial courts in our state. And my question is, in reading the briefs, all the briefs, is if they lack subject matter jurisdiction in this instance, who has it?
Well, I think that's a great point. And as the Court of Appeals pointed out in State v. Navarstead, which is an unpublished opinion from 2015, but has almost identical facts to this case, circuit courts have subject matter jurisdiction over all OWI first offenses. Circuit courts have subject matter jurisdiction over all OWI second offenses. In fact, circuit courts have subject matter jurisdiction over every kind of OWI case that can be brought in Wisconsin.
Counsel, I have the Rohner opinion here. Looks like a pretty good opinion to me. Why shouldn't we follow it?
I think this court can follow Rohner and follow Mikrut. To the extent, there's two choices with Rohner. First, the court can clarify Rohner's ruling. Rohner did not cite the Wisconsin Constitution. It did use the phrase subject matter jurisdiction, but it based the loss of court authority entirely on a statutory provision, which this court has later clarified means court competency. So you can clarify Rohner's decision by pointing out that the loss of court authority is a loss of court competency rather than subject matter jurisdiction. And I'd point out, this court has said that courts didn't always rigidly distinguish between those terminologies, the subject matter jurisdiction versus court competency, because in the vast majority of cases, as long as the challenge is brought within a reasonable amount of time, the distinction is meaningless. If a court is without competency or without subject matter jurisdiction, if the challenge is brought within a reasonable amount of time, the case is over. The court can also distinguish Rohner. Rohner is a very factually distinguishable case from the present case. In Rohner, the prosecutor had actual knowledge of an actual prior conviction and decided to proceed anyway. The defendant stipulated that it was an actual prior conviction. And the challenge was brought within a reasonable time, and Rohner expressly stated the defendant could still be retried for the criminal charge. So factually, that case is distinguishable, too. But I think a careful reading of Rohner and the purpose of Wisconsin's drunk driving laws make it hard to reconcile the broad reading that Ruth Britton asked this court to give Rohner.
Is there any question that City of Eau Claire did not know about the Minnesota conviction in 1992?
There are no facts and evidence that show that the city knew or should have known. And I'd point on a motion to vacate, the party moving to vacate a judgment based on the policy of the finality of judgments has the burden. And so without any facts in the record, I think it has to be assumed that the city did not know, or there's no reason the city should have known, because there's nothing in the facts that were stipulated to point otherwise.
Well, suppose one of your predecessors, we found a predecessor from 1992 and said, oh, yeah, I remember that case. Yeah, she did tell me about that, but I thought I had the authority to charge under the city ordinance.
I think as an officer of the court, we'd have an obligation to report that to the court.
But what would be the result if it was reported?
I still think the result should be a loss of court competency. The issue would be whether or not the challenge was brought in a reasonable time. And I think if someone could establish the prosecutor knew about the prior conviction and decided to proceed anyway, the court does have the authority to disregard the waiver or forfeiture and decide to entertain the motion to vacate anyway.
Okay. Does the prosecutor have some sort of duty? Let's say going back to 1992 or even now, what is the duty on the part of the prosecutor to find out what the background is, unless you're saying that the defendant has the duty to disclose?
I don't believe a defendant has a duty to disclose, although I do think the defendant needs to bring the challenge to court authority within a reasonable amount of time for the court to be able to hear the challenge. I think prosecutors have a duty to diligently investigate, and this court has said prosecutors have a duty, if they're going to ask for enhanced penalties, to provide evidence to the court demonstrating that enhanced penalties are called for. I don't think prosecutors have a duty to know everything. And I think it's an unreasonable burden to put on prosecutors to say, even if there's an unknown out-of-state conviction, we're going to vacate the judgment altogether because of the existence of this conviction, which the defendant knew about. Now, again, I'm not arguing the defendant has a duty to disclose it, but they do. I think it's reasonable to say they have a duty to bring the challenge to court authority based on something they know about within a reasonable amount of time.
Counsel, in another case, the state of Wisconsin versus Benjamin Stroman, Court of Appeals Judge Hrues, in addressing the issue of duty, says this in paragraph 14. Defendants have no obligation to disclose prior offenses, and I emphasize, the establishment of prior offenses is unquestionably a duty belonging to the state. Do you think that's a correct statement of law?
Sure. I think the state has a duty to be reasonably diligent in investigating prior convictions. But again, I think accepting Booth Britton's interpretation puts an impossible duty on prosecutors because there are so many, particularly out-of-state convictions, which there is no way the prosecution can know about. It's not in their Wisconsin driving record. Many of them are not reported to the national database. The Department of Transportation does a fantastic job of finding these out-of-state convictions, but there are still many that are not reported, and this is a regular problem. I'm out of time.
I have a question, and that is that Mueller and subsequent cases and McRoot all rely on the state constitution, right? The state constitution says, except as otherwise provided by law, the circuit courts have jurisdiction. But that's dropped the phrase, except as otherwise provided by law. It just doesn't appear in Mueller, doesn't appear in McRoot. And if you go back, I think that if you look at Eberhardy, where maybe this started developing, that this phrase is just omitted, and it's the plain language of the statute. The Constitution, which says that the state legislature can provide for limitations on the jurisdiction of the circuit courts. Isn't that what except as otherwise provided by law means?
I don't think it does, and I would point to the latter portion of that constitutional provision, which says within the state, in such appellate jurisdiction in the circuit as the legislature may prescribe by law. Now, if the intent of the Constitution was to provide the legislature the opportunity to prescribe the subject matter jurisdiction of circuit courts, I think they would have used the same language they used for appellate jurisdiction that they used for original subject matter jurisdiction.
Do you have any background on that? Because this was all part, I think, of the 78 constitutional revision. And it was carefully studied.
I don't have any case law on it. I would point the court to Jack Stark's commentary on the Wisconsin Constitution.
It's his textbook on this.
Yes, which does say that the 1977 changes to the Wisconsin Constitution withdrew the ability of the legislature to revoke subject matter jurisdiction of circuit courts.
May I ask just
thank you.
Question.
Yes,
please. The difference, Judge Gabler, the circuit court judge in this case, I found his opinion quite interesting. And he says, okay, you have subject matter jurisdiction. The question is, can you invoke it? He essentially says, and I paraphrase, that we have all sorts of requirements that are conditions that must be met before you can invoke subject matter jurisdiction. Look at a personal injury case, he says. There are requirements before you can maintain a personal injury action and invoke the subject matter jurisdiction that must be met. He says that applies here, that subject matter jurisdiction can only be invoked in a first offense OWI if it is brought by the state. Only the state has any authority to commence a criminal OWI. Can you respond to that?
Sure. What Judge Gabler is describing is court competency, whether a court is competent to exercise its constitutionally granted subject matter jurisdiction. And I think, you know, the circuit court opinion fails to recognize McRoot in following cases. And in McRoot, again, the same issue that's at play in this case, whether or not a community had statutory authority to issue a uniform traffic citation. Same issue we had here. And this court said in McRoot that a court issuing a citation without statutory authority is issuing it without competency, not without subject matter jurisdiction. And I would point to Justice Abrahamson's Shopper Advertising concurring and dissenting opinion, where she said, how we define subject matter jurisdiction and court competency is not the most important thing. The most important thing is that it's clearly defined and consistently applied. And since McRoot was issued, for the most part, these two concepts have not been more consistently applied since we started to see the distinction between the two in the late 70s or early 80s than we have since that opinion was issued. And I think it is a clear rule that offers some predictability. And again, I think for the most part it's been consistently applied. To the extent McRoot has a flaw, I think Justice Abrahamson pointed it out in her concurring opinion in the McRoot decision, in which she said this opinion overrules or calls into doubt a whole series of cases without naming them. And so this case is an opportunity to clarify Rohner, one of the unnamed opinions that, if not overruled, and I think Rohner and McRoot can be reconciled, to a certain extent the language or terminology used is called into doubt.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Rogensack, I am Diane Lowe, counsel of record for the respondent. I ask today that this court affirm the 2015 ruling of the trial court, which comes to you directly via bypass petition. In this ruling, Presiding Judge William Gabler of the Eau Claire County Circuit Court, Branch 3, properly held that the respondent's 1992 operating while intoxicated civil default judgment is void and could properly be vacated as the original court lacks subject matter jurisdiction to hear the case. In 1990, 2 years before the Eau Claire default judgment, respondent was convicted of drunk driving in Minnesota. This was a prior countable offense under the escalating penalty provisions of Wisconsin Statute 34665. It was not counted, and it should have been. So she was incorrectly charged as a civil defendant when she should have been charged as a criminal defendant.
Why?
Harmless error.
Why? Why?
Because under 343-307, the counting statute, with respect to other states, there was a 1991 law change which removed the provisions stating the elements had to match. And in 1993, Wisconsin v. White stated specifically that 1990 Minnesota criminal convictions were to be counted.
Did she bring it to the court's attention?
She didn't even attend the hearing. She, in fact, really didn't realize what happened to this case until a couple years ago when someone brought it up upon reviewing her record.
She didn't get a ticket? She didn't even know this was
happening?
Well, she
got a ticket, she went to jail, she was released, and then she moved away.
Okay. But her objection was, this ticket's a first offense. It really should be a criminal offense.
She did not object until about 2 years ago, in 2014, when it was brought to her attention by the Superior Public Defender's Office.
See, actually, most people would object the opposite way. They would say, please don't count my prior offense. I would prefer to be charged civilly, and I don't want to face criminal charges. It's sort of an interesting argument you make today. I mean, if anyone's going to know about the prior, she would.
Correct.
And if she really wanted to be charged with a crime, she would have been in the best position to make that request, I guess, right?
Well, as the city attorney's office so aptly puts in several of their briefs, she had a criminal defense attorney at all her subsequent hearings and convictions. So I believe that that is indicative that had she been charged criminally properly, she would have been defended. And there might have been a defense which would have led to a dismissal. But because she wasn't advised of her right to an attorney, as she should have been had this matter been properly charged, she was without that representation.
Is your position that the city of Eau Claire was negligent?
Well, my position is that the city of Eau Claire failed to follow the mandatory language laid down by the legislators stating shall in every single paragraph of the escalating provisions of 34665 as well as 343307. Now, they question repeatedly their obligation to count out-of-state convictions. However, the law is clear, and there's no exception in the law which states that if you don't understand it or if you had a good faith intention, then that's okay, it's hard to find, we know that it's difficult. City Attorney's Office would have had the obligation to discover that Minnesota conviction on their own. The defendant had no duty to disclose that. And it's very clear in the statutes as well as in the case law.
But now this defendant had a criminal conviction in Minnesota.
Correct.
And this defendant got the benefits of a civil conviction in Wisconsin. And in other words, she did not go to jail for 5 days.
Correct.
She was not fined after her conviction. How long was she suspended and driving?
I'm not aware of what the exact amount was offhand. It could have been moved away, and it could have been a year.
But she received really some significant benefits by not being convicted of a criminal offense. And what you're arguing here is, let's wipe out this offense entirely. Something she didn't complain about on the third offense or the fourth offense or the fifth offense or the sixth offense. Let's wipe out this one civil conviction here in a way that it really could not possibly be retried. So it just evaporates. And then she doesn't have to go to prison on a mandatory sentence for the seventh offense.
Now, I think that's a very interesting comment, Your Honor, but the fact of the matter is once the error was made, by the city attorney's office, the DMV reflected the error and not the correct circumstances. So when she was subsequently tried and convicted, it would have been easy for the defense attorneys to miss that when they reviewed the record, and perhaps she just maintained silence, but that shouldn't be effective in terms of whether it could be overturned under Walworth v. Roner.
Is the municipality's failure to find the previous conviction an error if it is an impossibility? For instance, when I started as an assistant district attorney, I remember the state was just transferring to electronic records, the computerized system we're all so familiar with now. And the way that the counties kept track of prior convictions in the early 90s was on 3x5 index cards. And when a charging document or when a referral came in from the local law enforcement agency, the on-duty prosecutor would then go consult the filing cabinets and see if there were any priors, and then perhaps have discussions with other prosecutors in the office, if there were any, and say, have you heard of any other priors? Yes, I think I've heard of one in a neighboring county. That's how it used to be up until very recently. And so I can very easily envision a circumstance where it was simply impossible to locate a conviction from a foreign jurisdiction. Is it error if it's an impossibility?
Well, I agree with you that especially back in the time in the early 80s and 90s when computers weren't as prevalent, that it would be extremely difficult at times to find the other convictions, and I sympathize with that. But the law is mandatory, and if they want to make an exception for circumstances where there's an impossibility, that should be done via another mechanism, not by saying we're going to disregard mandatory statutes.
Well, okay, so what is, you mentioned in response to a question from Justice Prosser that the relevant statutes are replete with the mandatory shall. What is the shall that Eau Claire violated when it failed to include the previous conviction from Minnesota?
It's a combination of the two statutes, 343-307 and 34665. They shall include the prior convictions in determining the charging decision for what level she should be charged at.
And
the Minnesota portion comes in with 343-307, counting other states in combination to the Court of Appeals decision that states that, yes, Minnesota convictions shall be counted. They use the mandatory word shall as well.
Well, I guess an argument could be made that they did follow that in terms of all of the records they either had or, I mean, you're not alleging, I didn't see it anywhere in the briefing, that they had it and they hid it or concealed it.
No.
It would make little sense if that were the case. But in a sense, what I hear you saying is true. It is true, beyond dispute, shall include the records. Well, if they don't have the records and it's impossible to get the records, isn't not arguably true that they fulfilled their obligation and that there were no records?
There's no excusable exception in that statute. So I believe that the legislators considered that and decided that it was important enough public policy-wise, constitutional-wise, to ensure uniform charging decisions across the state and to ensure that people are properly charged, that they deliberately did not make an exception.
Counsel, I understood, and I'd like your help on this. I understood the shall in that provision back when I used to try a lot of these in the early 90s as a prosecutor to mean that the state should not be in a position to really negotiate down and pretend that a prior didn't exist. Because before that, people might say, gosh, she'd plead to a first offense. Can we just pretend that the second, this isn't a second offense? And there might be plea negotiations on a weaker case or something like that. But the legislature, I think, said shall, meaning, hey, if it's there, you can't do it. We intend that people who commit a second offense be charged with a second offense. Do you have any indication that the shall was really meant to be applied the way you're asking this court to apply it today?
No, I believe that subsequent cases have made clear that even if they're not aware of the conviction, it's still to be counted under that language that there is a duty to investigate and find that.
Okay. How does it work federally? There are offenses that could count be on federal property. Is that all inputted into the state database?
I'm not aware of that.
It's an interesting argument you're making. But if the state doesn't know and the defendant is in the best position, do you think we should have a requirement? I mean, the defendant has a right not to incriminate themselves. So when they sit in the best position to know about their prior offenses, I mean, it sort of seems respectfully that what's happened here is she now faces a seventh offense. She faces mandatory prison. The laws have changed. 7, 8, and 9, you mandatorily go for a long time to prison. And so it's real appealing for her to make that seventh a sixth, right?
Correct. It's a matter of four possible potential years once you issue your decision.
So would then the ramifications in this case be, I mean, you can't have 2 6th offenses, right?
Correct.
So everything would cycle down, and would her sentences have to change on all those previous offenses?
Well,
would they all be eliminated? What's the fallout?
Well, I believe the fallout would be it would go back to the court in Superior, and they would add the seventh back, and they would consider the sentencing in light of your ruling, as well as the DMV.
But she faces the seventh, right? Isn't this a seventh?
This is a seventh.
Which is why be nice to make it a sixth, right?
Correct.
I mean, that's why you want to eliminate one of the priors, because
that
changes
correct.
The whole category of where she ends up. Okay.
I'm interested in hearing your response to your opposing counsel's observation in regard to the state of Illinois. And in that, he mentioned that in the state of Illinois, there is a program where those who are convicted of the offensive operation of a motor vehicle while under the influence of an intoxicant are placed within a category of what is referred to as supervision, and therefore not available for detection even among the most diligent of all prosecutors, even if a prosecuting entity was to assign a full-time staff person to call every jurisdiction in the nation, as impossible as that would be. But say that hypothetical person existed and called the state of Illinois and said, hey, we have Susie Smith here. Has she ever been convicted of operation of a motor vehicle under the influence of an intoxicant in the great state of Illinois? And the person on the other end of the line says, completely honestly, not according to our records. Okay. Still, even under those circumstances, your position is the city would have had the obligation to have included that conviction in the charging document.
Well, I wholeheartedly sympathize with and understand where your comments are coming from.
I don't care whether you sympathize or not with the city. I'm just asking if you still think that they had a duty to include it.
I believe Minnesota, which is the one at issue, definitely should have been included.
It's
because
ma'am. I appreciate your efforts to zealously represent your client. One of the things that differentiates this court from all other courts in our state is we have the obligation not to look just at the actors, the relevant people in the case before us, but we have the obligation to write a case that's going to stand for law for every similarly situated person in the state. Now, I am asking, I'm directing your attention to this very real possibility. Minnesota borders us to the west and north, Illinois directly to the south. It is not beyond the realm of possibility. In fact, it's well within that there are going to be convictions in the state of Illinois, and I'm asking for your response to that.
Yes, Your Honor. What I see is problematic on stating that you can disregard the Illinois convictions because you can't discover them is that you are then telling prosecutors that you can disregard mandatory statutes. So perhaps an idea to address that would be to use this case as a vehicle to carve out an exception where there is an impossibility, but that exception does not currently exist. But I am afraid if you say, without carving out an exception, go ahead and disregard the mandatory statutes, that could have a ripple effect in a poor way.
In your response to my question, you used the word disregard three times. And my question to you in response would be, how can one be said to disregard something that one is unaware of?
Disregard or, right, I acknowledge that.
Thank you.
What is the remedy, if you know, for collateral attacks on OWIs? Often, on occasion, we'll see a collateral attack, let's say an attack on an OWI in the state of Georgia, and there's nothing to indicate that that plea there was a defense attorney, that their plea was freely and voluntarily made. And so that conviction in another state is not counted because there's been no showing that there's been compliance with a knowing and voluntary, intelligent and voluntary plea. What's the remedy then for a successful collateral attack on a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary plea, if you know?
I don't know.
Can you discuss with me what the terms, what is meant in 343.307.1D's last phrase, where it says substantially similar terms used in that jurisdiction's laws?
And I'm glad you just raised that point, because I just was thinking that that may be part of an answer to your concern, because then if they don't publish them at all, it may not be considered substantially similar. But from what I understand based on case law, substantially similar has been thrown wide open such that just about every state is included.
Well, it's a conviction under the law of another jurisdiction. Can another jurisdiction be India?
I don't know.
Mexico? I mean, where does it stop? Is there any point where the state doesn't have to explore the world to figure out any possible prior conviction?
Well, I think that's a good point. Expanding on his impossibility argument, the policy reasons behind the escalating provisions in counting other states is to ensure that someone doesn't move in with perhaps 10 OWIs and comes in and gets charged at the beginning again, to ensure the punishment matches the behavior for the lifetime of the person, not based solely on where they're at in terms of locality. So under that analysis, then you would think that other countries could be included, but just like Illinois, there would be an impossibility, I'm sure, to discover that. But I think that as we go forward, it will be less and less of a problem given the communication systems between the states.
Cases sometimes can proceed in different frameworks of analysis. And here we were talking about McRoot, and we're talking about the Roehner decision, and competency and subject matter jurisdiction. In my prior question, I touched upon collateral attack because a plea entered is not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. Here, I think the facts are that for this potentially first offense, it's now being asserted that it was really criminal, the defendant received a citation, which I assume said something like, show up at such and such a date, and if you don't show up, a default can be entered, or something like that. Clearly, the defendant wasn't advised of the criminal rights. What import, if any, does that have on the validity of the proceedings and the ability to count the conviction as a valid conviction?
Well, I think it definitely should not be counted because the court didn't properly hear it. So under Rohner, if it should be in the criminal courts and it's tried in the civil courts, it's definitely not valid and should be vacated.
But the remedy you're seeking here is basically to wipe out the conviction entirely under circumstances in which it, for all practical purposes, it could not be retried. It's a freebie. And where the defendant should have served 5 days in jail, minimum, she didn't serve any time in jail. The policy implications of what you're arguing. You're arguing that there's this duty even in the face of impossibility, and even when the defendant really received the benefits of a plea and didn't need the protections of a criminal defense. I mean, apparently she did not even show up in court. If you have an offense, you might say, no, I wasn't drunk or some kind of defense. He didn't even offer any defense at all.
But, Your Honor, she should have had a criminal defense attorney. She was really a criminal defendant. She was not advised of what the true nature of her crime was, and now she's facing potentially 4 extra years of imprisonment because of the civil ticket that she did not show up for because she thought it was nothing important,
perhaps. In this particular case, the defendant has 5 criminal convictions and 1 civil conviction. So, I mean, in Minnesota, it was a criminal conviction. I assume she had an attorney there.
I don't know if she had an attorney.
The reason there's this anomaly is that Wisconsin, to the best of my knowledge, is the only state in which the first offense is civil.
Correct.
Okay. And Justice Ziegler explained the policy here that given that leniency on a first offense, we're not going to allow that to happen a second time. It must be charged as a criminal offense a second time because we're not going to let you get one civil offense after another. And when you have a second offense that is criminal, you are entitled to an attorney and other protections. But none of the bad consequences of a second offense conviction are in play here.
Your Honor, I think a very important point to keep in mind is the mandatory duty and the results that may follow if you tell prosecutors and city attorneys across the state that we're not going to hold you to the mandatory statutes. We're not going to hold you to giving someone a proper right to a defense attorney if they're entitled to one. We're not going to hold you to properly charging someone. They were the ones who were required to find the prior. They did not. Now, if there needs to be an exception carved out, I think that the substantially similar portion of the statute of 343307 may partially address that, but I'm concerned, if you look at it that way, that there can be havoc created in charging decisions throughout the state.
See, and I see Rohner is actually supporting what Justice Prosser just referenced. I mean, there you had a situation where the state knew there was another offense, wanted to charge that other offense, and felt that it could not charge that other offense. And the court said, you have to charge that. But the difference is they knew about it, and the policy considerations behind the statute seem to be you can't go ahead and do first offense after first offense after first offense. You need to include offenses from this or other jurisdiction and charge them accordingly. I didn't understand the statute to work as an escape valve for criminal responsibility when it's known and due. What's your best argument as to what the intent of the shall in that statute, what was it supposed to mean?
Well, I think that that's a counterproductive interpretation because it encourages sloppy work and neglect on the part of the city attorney's office. You have heard him state he is questioning even his necessity of finding other states. So if you don't hold them to the mandatory nature of the statute, I'm afraid that sooner they are going to just stop looking, and then the statute will just be wholly disregarded.
You think DAs are going to stop looking for prior offenses?
Well, I think they won't take it as seriously, just like with motions to suppress and following the proper protocol to obtain illegally evidence. I think it's comparable to that if you allow them to start mischarging someone by not following up and looking for that prior crime or finding it or making a mistake, then they need to be held accountable, not the defendant. And you're right, it does seem like a windfall to her, but it certainly has not been over the years.
Well, the result, should you win, or retain your win, is that this conviction, this civil forfeiture, would be overturned, right? Made void.
Correct. Oh, it's already made.
And then, when you go back on your seventh charge, it becomes the sixth charge, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that would change the penalty.
H to G.
And that's the purpose of all of this, isn't it?
Well, it's part of the purpose, but second, just to have a blemish on your record removed, that's incorrect.
How do you think it would work if you had a trial? Let's say that she went to trial on this ticket. And she's on the stand explaining it wasn't me or whatever, you know, assume she's on the stand. Would she then, what happens if the state says, or the county or the city says, I mean, would they be able to ask, have you ever been convicted of prior? And then if she tells the truth, what happens to that? Would there be double jeopardy that attaches?
Well, I think you have a right to remain silent, and that...
Not if you're on the stand. Assuming she wants to defend herself in some way.
If she tells them about a prior OWI that they haven't discovered, is that your question?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if she's not represented by an attorney and she's also told that she's a civil defendant, I would definitely have that excluded. But if it's a criminal trial,
Well, it wouldn't be. It's this ticket. And they find out for the first time, oh, gosh, this should have been a second.
Well, it's not an issue that in this case, but I certainly would state that she should have had a criminal defense attorney, as was her right, to be present and advise her that she could remain silent and did not have to have an obligation to answer those questions. It's not her duty. It's the city's duty, and it's the state's duty to discover those prior offenses under the mandatory law.
Thank you. Thank you.
Going back to Justice Bradley's earlier question about municipal courts, it occurred to me to cite or point the court to the Village of Elm Grove v. Brefka decision, in which another statutory provision in Wisconsin's drunk driving law was not followed, and what the court said was that the court lacked competency to enter the judgment. The court did not say the court was without subject matter jurisdiction.
Counsel, since you started with that focus, you ended also with, well, you know, since McRoot, it's kind of clear. In footnote 2 in the Navistad case, which is one of the Court of Appeals cases that addressed the issue, essentially, that we have before us, footnote 2 cites four cases, two of which were issued after 2009, an important date, and two prior to that, but including the Lowry decision, which does the very thing that you said is now cleaned up. I mean, I look at the Lowry decision, which was decided in 2015, and it says, the problem with the state's argument, however, is that the court never had competency because the court didn't have subject matter jurisdiction. You know, so, and that's what the Navistad case, which is supportive of you, is the only one that, at least that's been brought to my attention, that is supportive of you, and the other four cases set forth in footnote 2 would not be supportive of you and don't have this great clarity that you're indicating now exists in SNCRU.
Well, there's two court of appeals decisions, both unpublished, Navistad and Lowry, which have examined the issue in front of the court today. I will concede Lowry did decide the issue in the way that Booth Britton argues the court should. Navistad had the benefit of looking at the Lowry case and interpret it in the way that the city asked the court to interpret it. The other cases, in addition to some being unpublished, this issue, court competency versus subject matter jurisdiction, was not an issue in that case.
I don't know because I haven't read all of these, but footnote 2 says there are at least two additional unpublished decisions reaching the same result as Lowry, and that's the Potts case and the Pettis case, and then it goes on to state, and in addition, there are other cases, but we can't cite them for persuasive authority because they were prior to the 2009-ish decision of this court about being able to cite unpublished opinions as persuasive. But I take from this footnote that the footnote says to me that they are in accord with your opposing counsel. That is, they're in accord with Lowry, and Lowry is in accord with your opposing counsel. What am I missing there?
Well, a couple things. Clark County.
You only tell me one. Tell me the big thing.
Respectfully.
I think he has time to cover both.
In Potts, the parties agreed the judgment was void if the prior Massachusetts conviction was substantially similar to Wisconsin. So this subject matter jurisdiction versus court competency was not an issue. I believe Pettis also predates the July 1st, 2009.
Maybe.
The Cron case involves double jeopardy, does not involve this issue. State v. Stroman covered whether or not the criminal statute of limitations tolls for a civil conviction, decided it not. There are two unpublished cases that have examined the issue in front of the court today. They've split. I think that's part of the reason why the court granted our petition for bypass.
I read this footnote as saying or suggesting these cases that are cited here are in accord with your opposing counsel.
Not
because I say, it says there are at least two additional unpublished decisions reaching the same result as Lowry, and Lowry certainly is in accord with your opposing counsel. So.
No. There are two cases that have examined this issue. They've come on both sides. And I'd point to, even looking at, the court wants to examine the pre-2009 unpublished opinions, you can see the circuit courts often came out in favor of the way we ask. There has been a mix on this issue. I do think the Mikrut rule is a clear, bright line that's not terribly well understood yet.
If it's so clear and bright, how come it's not understood?
Because I think parties are used to looking at old case law, which haven't been, as you pointed out in your concurring opinion in Mikrut, weren't explicitly overruled or explicitly called into question. And so they apply a case like Rohner, because in Lowry they said, well, Rohner didn't explicitly overrule,
Mikrut.
Or Mikrut didn't explicitly overrule Rohner. That's true, but understood together, it's a the statutes can't revoke the subject matter jurisdiction of the court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for fine arguments. Just when you think you understand exactly how all these statutes fit together for OWI, you find there are other facts which tend to turn that around on its head. And thank you for the arguments, and thank you for fine briefs. We are now going to adjourn for the lunch break. The court will be back for its third case at 1:30. Thank you.